In late October of 2010, a young public defender named Ben Goldsmith was reading the Seattle Times when he spotted a piece about a new development in a murder case out in Redmond. The headline read, "Sex Offender Charged in 2008 Redmond Halloween Slaying."
When you're in this line of work, you're looking for the challenging, complicated cases. And just from seeing the news article about this, it seemed like this case was all of those things. There was DNA involved, which was going to make the case complicated. It was a homicide, which also made the case complicated. And, you know, clearly the stakes were high.
Ben finished the article with great interest. He did not see a lot of these kinds of cases in the area.
In Seattle, homicide of a stranger, so not a domestic violence situation, but a situation where it's actually unclear what the connection is, those cases are more rare. And I think there's more of a chance of some sort of injustice being done against the person charged.
From the time Ben was growing up in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts, he'd wanted to go into law enforcement, put the bad guys away, make the world just a little more just. Then in college, he landed an internship at a public defender's office in Washington, D.C.
And within a week of working there, I realized that, you know, all the reasons why I thought I wanted to be a police officer or an FBI agent or a prosecutor, which were to protect people, that all those reasons were much better served for me by being a public defender.
What Ben had seen that summer was a system that was too often broken.
How police lie, how the system can be rigged. Those are all things that people directly affected by the system and people who work in the system, like public defenders, have known for a long time.
Ben saw it as his role to fight against injustice. And after he moved west to Seattle and became a public defender and gained more experience, he faced what all public defenders do, an overwhelming caseload every single day. But to Ben, the work was more than just a grind, which is why he's lasted at the office as long as he has. It was a passion, something he found difficult to switch off. He worked nights, weekends, even as he started a family. More and more, he gravitated towards the toughest cases. Cases that weren't straightforward, that required exhaustive research and inventive strategies, and he litigated them ferociously. I've known Ben for a few years now. Talked to him for hours, listened to hours more of his interviews and depositions, read a small library worth of court transcripts. And here's what I'd say. Ben is incredibly smart. He's also unafraid of speaking his mind and pissing people off.
He's not, I wouldn't say he's well-loved by the prosecutors. Ben is very sure of himself and he's very smart and he's very talented and he doesn't... That's not lost on him all the time.
Catherine Edwards, one of his colleagues, pointed out to me that this does not endear Ben to everyone he meets.
He'll kill me for saying this, but he can come across as a little arrogant. And he doesn't suffer fools at all. And there are certainly a lot of fools in the prosecutor's office.
In 2010, as Ben read that article in the paper about Emmanuel Fair's arrest, he realized that this case was in many ways made for him.
It seemed like a situation where, because Emmanuel's black, the decedent was not. Because of Emmanuel's prior record, he was certainly not like a person of means. It seemed like there are all these things that were aligning against Emmanuel, which made it all that much more important to be the person who would try to help.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Campside Media and Wondery, I'm Matthew Scherr, and this is Suspect. This is episode 6 in our 9-part series, Dead Time. The call in which Emmanuel Fair learned he'd been charged with the murder of Arpana Janaga occurred on October 30th, 2010. He'd already been behind bars for 13 months for his parole violation, and he'd served out most of his time on McNeil Island, a historic prison in the middle of Puget Sound, about 30 miles south of Seattle. Emmanuel thought life on McNeil Island was okay by prison standards. He had a lot of freedom of movement. He spent time outside. Prisoners called it camp. But that changed once Emmanuel was charged with murder and was transferred to King County Jail in downtown Seattle. King County Jail is not a prison. It's not meant to house human beings for long periods of time. It's a temporary holding facility. And it was noisy and overcrowded, with new inmates pouring in every day and old inmates pouring out with the same frequency. To pass the time, Emmanuel read the Bible, slept a lot, and he wrote letters. Some of those letters were addressed to me in my home in Georgia. I would like to bring awareness to this case, and in doing so, I believe more interest will come, he wrote, and asked if I'd be interested in doing an article on him. At other points, he worried about what he considered to be the racial discrimination he'd experienced during the investigation. It's crazy, he said, how here in Seattle, Washington, this county uses Martin Luther King Jr.'s image and name, and yet this county does not represent what he stood for. The criminal justice system is so biased here, and it's hard as a minority to receive a fair trial. When I'm released, I plan to advocate to change this county's name.
Let me ask you a question. The letters you send me from jail... Tell me about how you would sit, where you would be sitting in the jail when you wrote those.
Or I'll probably be sitting at the day room table or something with a little tissue in my ear because everybody's loud. You know what I'm saying? And just try to tune everything out and just, you know, draw or write, you know.
Did you draw a lot in jail?
Yeah, I drew a lot. A lot of people, like, they have family members' birthdays. I would draw portraits for them and stuff. So I was doing that a lot.
You get pen, paper?
Yep.
As much as you want?
Well, they only give you pencils in the jail. But there was a lot of officers that knew I knew how to draw. They was giving me pens. He was like, flush it down the toilet when you're dead. You know what I'm saying? Yep.
What kept Emmanuel going back then was his determination to take matters into his own hands, in his own case. To prove to his family and friends that he had not done this, that this was not him.
You know, I used to tell people I don't want to be like the guys that we see in the news that do 20 and 30 years, you know what I'm saying, just to come back and get everything overturned and exonerated.
When Emmanuel was first charged with murder, his attorney had been an older public defender, close to retirement. Emmanuel did not think the guy was giving his case the attention it deserved.
So the first 2 years I sat in jail, it was just dead time, you know? And, like, I remember one time I was waiting 7 months just to get an attorney visit. I'm calling, like, hey, are you still my attorney? And, you know, that lawyer had a death penalty case that he was more focused on. So, you know, he would come visit me when we should be discussing my case. He would have binders with other people's names on them, open it up, reading their discovery, reading their case during my face-to-face hour time. You know what I'm saying? It was just totally messed up.
Emmanuel knew he had a choice. Stick it out with an attorney who didn't seem to care about his case, or get rid of him and hope for someone more committed.
The day I fired him, he was whispering to me not to do this. He was like, don't do this, don't do this. And then he asked the judge for a minute, and he was telling me, I can win this case, I can win this case. And I was just tired. I had been in there too long without him coming. And he, you know, he's saying all this. And I just was like, I'm gonna have to win it with another attorney.
Soon after, paperwork bearing Emmanuel's name arrived on the downtown Seattle desk of a different public defender, Ben Goldsmith. It had been years since Ben had seen that newspaper clipping about Emmanuel, but he recognized the name at the top of the file right away. He remembered his earlier interest in the case, and he volunteered to take it. Within 24 hours, Ben was walking over to the King County Jail to meet his new client.
It was like, fair, you got a legal visit. I'm like, oh man, this is the new attorney. You know what I'm saying? So I go out there and I'm looking. Then I see this, like, I thought I was a little kid with salt and pepper hair. You know what I'm saying? I sat down, grabbed the phone. He grabbed the phone. He said, hello, I'm Benjamin Goldsmith. I'm your new attorney. You know what I'm saying? I'll never forget that, man.
Ben, clad in a suit and tie, tucking his backpack between his legs, peered back through the plexiglass at Emmanuel.
I'm sure you get this question all the time, but do you, with clients, make a decision at some point mentally about whether someone is telling the truth about their innocence?
No, absolutely not. And that really persists throughout the entire case. Part of what is really critically important in that first client meeting is forging a bond of trust with them. I mean, with Emmanuel and with many of my clients, first of all, being behind glass, brought into the room in handcuffs, where I'm on the other side of the glass and I'm free, and that affects the balance of power. Often they're black, brown, or people of color, and I'm white. That affects the balance of power. And oftentimes, both because of our clients' race and just because of the institutions we have in our country, you know, our clients are just historically disenfranchised and discriminated against, and that's not my experience. So all of those things play into just a chasm of mistrust that can exist between clients and attorneys, at least at the beginning. And one of the really core parts of my job is building a relationship with that client such that they trust me and trust my intentions and trust that I'm going to give every effort to defend them.
Ben's way to build that trust was to do the work, to show Emmanuel this case was a priority for him. But he also wanted to set realistic expectations. Investigators and prosecutors had amassed an enormous library of documentation and evidence, and Ben would have to wade through it all before he could form a strategy. He enlisted another young public defender named Paul Vernon, and the two of them started cranking through the files. They began to form their own theory. The police and prosecutors were prejudiced by the review of Emmanuel's priors, so they decided to commit themselves to building a case against Emmanuel while allowing a whole lot of other leads to go unchased. Ben calls it the tail wags the dog theory.
So tell us, in this case, do you remember if you had gut reactions when you took the pass through the initial paperwork, that initial discovery, and you were reading all of that?
My initial reactions were that it seemed like Cameron did it. For probably the first several hundred pages of discovery, Emmanuel was never even mentioned. And eventually Emmanuel did get mentioned, but I definitely had the impression as I read through the hundreds and then thousands of pages that usually when homicide cases are charged, there is more evidence against the person charged than I saw in this case.
Prosecutors had no eyewitnesses. No one had seen Emmanuel enter or leave Arpana's unit around the time the murder took place. No one had seen Emmanuel carry anything to the dumpster where police had later found Arpana's robe. Ben learned that what they did have was testimony from residents who had run into Emmanuel the next morning after the murder, at which point Emmanuel was enthusiastically helping to clean up trash and put away folding tables. Emmanuel was behaving normally, and he didn't smell like chemicals, which was important because of how much bleach had been poured over the crime scene. Above all, and this is something that has always stuck out to me since the first time I heard him explain it, Emmanuel did not leave the Valley View until 3 days after the party. Saturday, he hung out and watched TV. Sunday, he caught some football with a couple new friends. He seemed, in the memory of everyone he ran into, to be in good spirits, relaxed, not jumpy, not anxious. It hardly seemed like the behavior of a person who had just committed murder. So Ben revisited the investigator's theory, a vaguely formed one, that Emmanuel had killed Arpana in a fit of sexual rage. The theory relied on a few phone calls that Emmanuel had made in the early morning hours to Leslie Potts, although the two had never actually talked. And it relied on DNA. Emmanuel's DNA on Arpana's robe, the DNA on the duct tape, and the DNA on Arpana's neck.
When you thought about DNA as an investigative tool and then as a tool in the courts, what were your thoughts on kind of what it could do well and what its limitations were?
That's Eric Benson, one of the other reporters on the show, talking to Ben.
I think like most public defenders, my thoughts about forensic DNA were mixed. It can be a tool to exonerate the innocent. Innocence projects around the country and the world use it really effectively. But it's also a tool that the prosecution uses very effectively. And so that double-edged nature of it, that it could be very useful in defending Emmanuel, but that sometimes jurors hear that there is DNA evidence seeming to point at someone, and that's enough for them. They just sort of stop thinking. But I hadn't thought about it nearly as deeply as I did throughout the course of Emmanuel's case.
I think generally there's a lot of bad convictions. I mean, I'm absolutely 100% convinced there are people who have been convicted on DNA evidence who are absolutely innocent.
Bicca Barlow is trained as a scientist, but she's spent her career practicing law. In the past couple of decades, her specialty has been high-profile cases involving DNA. I first met Bicca a few years ago when The Atlantic magazine assigned me a story on forensic DNA and the many ways it can be misused in the criminal justice system. Bicca, like an increasing number of attorneys and scientists, believes that DNA is still the gold standard of forensic science when used correctly by an experienced lab analyst with peer-reviewed technology. But she also thinks that as technology has advanced, it has created its own problems, especially when it comes to trace or touch DNA, extremely small amounts of DNA that can be easily transferred.
When I first started out looking at this stuff, you needed lots and lots of material to have results. As one person I know always says, you needed buckets of blood, right? Something visible. And so you could understand the evidence and the identification of an individual based on the context of the case. And what's happened is we've moved from that era, which started in the 1980s, to the point now where every generation of tests is getting more and more and more sensitive. And it's not that they're better, it's just that they're able to detect tinier and tinier amounts. And we've shifted from looking at obvious biological fluids like blood and semen to testing what people call touch or contact DNA. You know, you go to a burglary and someone has entered through a door, and so that you test the doorknob of that door because you think the person may have touched it when they entered, looking for the perpetrator of the crime.
Today, some of these cutting-edge tests need only a microscopic amount of biological material. It doesn't have to be blood or saliva or semen. It can be a skin cell. The tests can confirm the presence of your DNA on a surface, a doorknob, a steering wheel, a gun. that you happened to touch at some point years earlier. They can also turn up positive results on surfaces you never touched at all. Say you shake hands with someone, give them a hug, hand them a pen, and then later in the day, that person touches the handle of a pistol. There's a decent chance your DNA would turn up on that gun handle too.
What I think most of us don't understand is, you know, we leave our DNA everywhere. And I'm always thinking about scenarios in public places where I'm getting people's DNA on my hands and then maybe getting it on my face because I touch, you know, we all know are so aware now of touching your face, right? And it can lead to all sorts of crazy results.
The most famously crazy of these cases took place a decade ago in California. Story goes like this. In 2012, a tech investor was found murdered in his mansion outside of Silicon Valley. Police quickly zeroed in on a suspect, a 26-year-old man with a long rap sheet. Crucially, police found the man's DNA on the victim's fingernails. They were certain they had their man. Then, a few weeks later, they discovered that their suspect had actually been miles away at the time of the murder, in a hospital.
His DNA got on the dead man's hands from paramedics that had been in contact with him earlier in the day. And so just because he's in the area is not corroborating. It's not evidence of crime. It's simply evidence that he was nearby. But there were tons and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people in the area who were nearby.
In that case, the suspect actually got lucky. He had a good alibi. If he hadn't, he'd probably be sitting in prison right now. Because DNA is the gold standard, many defense attorneys see a DNA match and they throw up their hands.
But I think there's a lot of people who are afraid that it's kind of like, oh, you get the DNA report, it says your client's there, you put it aside and you figure out how you can reach a deal, right? And not paying enough attention. And I can't blame, you know, defense attorneys who do that. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's competent representation, but I understand how terrifying it can be.
And when it comes to prosecutors, Bicca's noticed something else. An increasing number of them are using DNA evidence not to find a culprit, but to confirm the guilt of a person they already suspect. And as Bicca points out, that suspect is often a person of color. Young Black men, specifically, have far more contact with the criminal justice system than any other demographic group.
Well, I think not all police officers operate this way, but a lot do. Once they've identified an individual, they want to build a case against that person. And they're not investigating the crime anymore. They're now focused on an individual, and they're looking for any evidence they can to point to that person. And so it's moving from almost confirmatory testing, right? You have a suspect in mind, which is what they used to do, to now relying almost 100% on DNA as evidence of guilt, even if there's hardly any evidence supporting that theory.
For Ben Goldsmith, that's exactly what happened in the Arpana Janaga murder investigation. Arpana's apartment contained DNA from multiple people in profiles. Cameron Johnson's DNA was on the motor oil bottle. Aaron Gertler's semen was on a towel in the bedroom, and a trace of his DNA was on a sheet that had been placed over Arpana's body. And then there was the DNA on Arpana's wrist that didn't seem to match anyone she knew. Finally, there was the boot lace, which had been soaked in motor oil and later placed in a shopping bag and thrown into the dumpster next to the Valley View. Detectives had initially homed in on the lace, which the medical examiner was fairly certain had been used to strangle Arpana. But Emmanuel's DNA was not on the boot lace. Neither was Cameron Johnson's. In fact, the only identifiable person whose DNA could not be ruled out from the boot lace was a Valley View resident named Josiah Lovett. Josiah had not even attended the party or ever been a suspect. But then again,
if you look at the evidence pointing towards anybody to the exclusion of all other evidence, it makes it seem as though that person is guilty.
Take Aaron Gertler.
We know that according to the evidence, it appeared he had a motive. He was in some sort of sexual relationship with Arpana. And then despite the fact that he claimed not to have been at her house for 2 weeks before her death, There was a towel with an unwashed semen stain from Erin Gertler in her bedroom, in one of the rooms in her apartment where she was hosting a party that night. In addition, the killer, after Arpanov was murdered, took a green sheet and carefully covered her naked body with it. And Erin Gertler's DNA was mixed with Arpanov's blood on a stain on that green sheet. The last person to touch that green sheet was the killer. So if you just focus in on Erin Gertler's DNA evidence and the evidence surrounding him, it makes it seem as though there's a fairly strong case that he, in fact, committed the murder.
But although cops might have considered him a person of interest at the start, they hadn't ever really considered Erin to be a serious suspect. At the end of his review of the Redmond Police Department's investigation, Ben Goldsmith had one big takeaway. Every suspect detectives had looked at had got the benefit of the doubt, except Emmanuel Fair.
Investigators in the course of our interviews of them said at times, well, Emmanuel was the only outsider at the party. That wasn't true. There were a lot of people not from the apartment complex at the party. What is true is that Emmanuel was the only Black person at the party. And I think to some degree, the fact that Emmanuel was Black, the fact that he had a prior criminal history, played into the fact that they really seemed to shift their focus, and their gut level reaction guided their investigation.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling t-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
. 2012 came and went, then 2013 and 2014. Emmanuel remained locked up in jail. With bail set at an unpayably high amount, there were only two paths his case could take. His name was cleared, or he was found guilty of first-degree murder. As the years passed, Emmanuel heard less and less from the people he'd counted as close friends.
I mean, I understand that time doesn't stop. You know what I'm saying? People have their own lives. They'd be busy and stuff, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I mean, I got tons of family, but I wasn't hearing from all of them. So not hearing from friends or, you know, any kind of advocates or support, you know what I'm saying? So I just, you know, grinded it out, you know, told myself to be proactive in helping my defense.
During this time, I talked to Emmanuel a lot, by phone, by letter, and Ben visited him as often as he could. Sometimes he'd pose Emmanuel a question. Are you sure you don't want to plead out? Innocence, he reminded his client, did not always save a defendant, especially when that defendant is a young Black man. But that question just reminded Emmanuel of similar discussions he'd had in the past with different defense attorneys, including his lawyer on the 2004 rape case.
They say things to scare you and be like, you need to just take this deal. You know what I'm saying? And then prosecutors say, you need to take this deal we're offering you, or we're going to give you 100 years. It's bully tactics, man.
With this case, Emmanuel was determined not to make the same mistake again. No plea. Not now. Not ever.
Ben has strict orders. You know what I'm saying? I told him, I'm not signing nothing but release papers. That's it.
Ben respected this. More important, by 2014, he was starting to feel more optimistic. He thought he had a good chance at getting Emmanuel's past convictions excluded from the trial on the grounds that they weren't relevant to the case and could potentially be prejudicial. After all, juries are not supposed to sit in judgment of a defendant's entire life or try to intuit their character. They're asked to focus on the narrow question of whether the prosecution has proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt. And the judge ultimately agreed with Ben. Emmanuel's priors were out. Soon, Ben had brought in a bunch of his own experts who were confident they could challenge the forensic evidence against Emmanuel. Then there was the investigation itself, which, as Ben saw it, had been problematic and riddled with errors from the start. He was going to scrutinize every last detail of it, starting with the lead detective.
So it is November 30th at 9.05 a.m. We are in a conference room in the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office with Lieutenant Brian Coates from the Redmond Police Department. Brian or Lieutenant Coates, we talked about recording before the recorders went on. Are you aware this interview is being recorded?
Yes, I am.
In late 2016, as the murder trial was drawing near, Ben Goldsmith conducted two pretrial interviews with Detective Brian Coates. Because prosecutors planned to call Coates as a witness, Ben was entitled to question the detective at length about every aspect of the investigation and his career.
So, Lieutenant, I wanted to start out by having you briefly tell us about your training and experience, but as of October 2008, when you started your work on this case.
My experience I was hired in 1991 as a police officer, so going back that way, then I realized you said subsequent to 2008, but 25 years total law enforcement experience.
Okay. Now, at this point in your career in 2008, had you been a detective on a case of this complexity?
No.
Okay. As of today in 2016, have you been on another case of the same complexity?
No.
Okay.
Ben's single greatest trait is probably his thoroughness. For example, he doesn't just learn enough DNA science to get by in a case that hinges on forensics. He learns enough to be able to lock horns with PhD forensic scientists. For Ben, one of the greatest sins in law enforcement is a lack of thoroughness, and what he sees is a reliance on gut instinct, bias, and assumption, rather than careful work. In his interview with Detective Coates, Ben hammered home this point. He asked him about the decisions he'd made in the investigation, the things he'd done, and the things he hadn't. For example, Coates had checked pawn shop databases for Arpana's missing phone and camera, but he had not followed up in person, and he never interviewed pawn shop employees about whether or not they'd interacted with a person who matched Cameron Johnson's description. Ben asked Coates about a biker friend of Arpana's, another member of her motorcycle club.
I think it's possible that that person, this quote-unquote biker friend who grabbed her arm and threatened her, was never identified?
It's possible. I'm just not sure.
Fair to say you did not do any follow-up to determine who that was?
I don't think so.
Okay.
And, Ben asked him, why had Coates allowed Cameron Johnson to hang on to his cell phone after that November 5th interview with police, the one in which Coates had concluded Cameron was lying about when he called Arpana? Coates had no answer. I don't know, he said. I mean, we typically would. Ben also knew that when Redmond police detectives had obtained a search warrant for Cameron Johnson's apartment, they'd found a lighter that appeared to have some dark, gooey liquid underneath it. Investigators had photographed the lighter, but they hadn't taken it into evidence, and they never tested the substance to see if it might match the motor oil poured over Arpana's body.
I mean, given that I think you told us earlier there had been at least an attempt to start a fire and there had been some burning of something in Miss Janaga's apartment and you hadn't determined what had started that, would it have made sense to seize that lighter?
It's hard to say. I don't know.
Okay. Do you think that is a mistake?
I'm not going to say that.
Okay. Did anybody swab the substance it was stuck in to see what it was?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I know I was curious about what the substance was, so I'm going to assume, but I'm not sure.
Okay. But
you probably know more than I do. But if it wasn't, is it a mistake? Hard to say.
For Ben, this was a sign of negligence. And he was starting to see what looked like a pattern. Coates and the other detectives seemed to be looking for reasons why Cameron didn't commit the crime, while acting in the opposite way towards Emmanuel.
Now, you then ask Mr. Johnson if he ever helped Arpana maintaining her motorcycle or helping her with anything around the house.
Yes.
It seems to me that you are attempting to give him an innocent explanation for how his DNA got on the motor oil bottle.
We are asking him for an explanation in the context of maybe being innocent.
And then you say that you have some heartburn trying to explain how his DNA got on the motor oil bottle.
I'm trying to explain that, yes.
Did Cameron ever give you an explanation of how his DNA could have innocently gotten on the motor oil?
I do not believe so, no.
Okay.
For Ben, Coates' insistence on giving Cameron the benefit of the doubt came to a head in one of Coates' final interviews with Cameron in 2010. This was before Emmanuel had been charged, but after Coates had been corresponding with Alison Dubois, the medium.
And then when you say to him, anything you can do to shake loose a memory that could help you be a better witness for us and not be such an asset for the defense when this thing goes to trial, because right now that's what you are. You are the reasonable doubt for the guy we're going to take to trial. So what did you mean by that?
You ever make a comment and wish you could just retract it right away? It sounds like how it sounds. Based on all of Cameron's idiosyncrasies and memory recall and lack of memory recall, it makes him look guilty when either he was or he was not involved. So that's kind of what I was referring to.
Anyway, Coates argues, isn't it possible Cameron and Emmanuel did it together, collaborated on the murder in some way? I'm going to interject here to point out that there is zero evidence, zero of any conspiracy, and both men have adamantly denied it. The best Coates can do is point out that Emmanuel and Cameron had both been calling women immediately before the murder, which puzzles Ben.
Is it your thought that Mr. Fair and Mr. Johnson were hanging out together? Mr. Fair was trying to arrange somebody to have sex with Mr. Johnson or both of them, and when he couldn't make that happen, they decided to just go rape and murder somebody?
I think that's a distinct possibility. The evidence shows that no, they're both awake. They're both talking on their phone. They're both talking about the same reason, being females and sex. Mm-hmm. So it just seems logical that they're together at least at some point later than they say.
Okay. Well, I think we'll come back to this in time, but that's helpful to understand your thoughts.
Finally, after more than 9 hours, the whole thing wound down.
Is there anything else you did in the course of this investigation that we have not talked about?
Probably, but nothing relevant, nothing I can recall.
Okay. It is 4:03.
So this is where things stand in the months before the murder trial commences. Prosecutors and police are sure the compelling DNA evidence against Emmanuel is enough to override any unanswered questions about the case. But Ben Goldsmith believes all that uncertainty means the prosecution's case is weak. He sees a pattern. Investigators, in his mind, have doubled down on Emmanuel Fair, filtered the evidence to keep the items that point to his guilt and dismiss the items that don't. All because the case against Emmanuel Fair, the only black man at the party, the only one with a substantial criminal record, is going to be the easiest kind of case to win. Of course, soon it won't be up to Ben or the prosecutors. It'll be up to 12 men and women in a room in downtown Seattle.
During the opening statements, that's when it was like, this is serious, you know? I had to be listening, paying attention, you know? This isn't some true crime podcast that I can listen to and have an opinion on.
That's on the next episode of Suspect.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Suspect ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Campside and Wondery, this is episode 6 of 9 of Suspect. Suspect was reported by Eric Benson, Natalia Winkleman, and me, Matthew Scher. Eric and I are producers. David Waters is the executive producer. Our editor is Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Field production by Kyle Norris. Aaliyah Papes and Callie Hitchcock are assistant producers. Fact-checking by Matthew Giles. Original music by Doug Slaywin and Netta Hadari. Consulting producers are Laura Ricciardi and Josie Duffy Rice. Our engineer is Jackie Sajiko. Mixing by Jackie Sajiko, Mark McAdam, and Garrett Tiedemann. Additional production assistance from Rod Sherwood. Studio engineer is Judd Caswell at Frog Hollow Studio in Topsom, Maine. At Campside, the executive producers are me, Vanessa Gregoriadis, Josh Dean, and Adam Hoff. For Wondery, Chris Siegel is the producer. Production assistance from Fiona Pastana. Managing producer is Lata Pandya. Executive producers are George Lavender, Marshall Louie, and Jen Sargent. You're about to hear a preview of Generation Y. While you're listening, make sure to follow Generation Y on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen to new episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
Tonight's case happened in 1998 in Reno, Nevada, or closer to Lake Tahoe, really, on the Nevada side. A man and his wife are driving down the mountain and have a terrible accident. The man survives, but his wife tragically dies. He calls 911, gets help. When the police show up, though, they don't feel like everything's as it seems. What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight, we're talking about the June 1st, 1998 death of Renette Bergna. In 1998, Peter was 45 and Renette was 49. They'd been married about 11 years at that point. On May 31st, 1998, Renette was coming back home after a 6-week tour in Italy. And Peter left a school booster club function so he could get to the airport in time to pick her up. He stopped to get some gas, and then at 10:15, he picked her up from the airport. But Peter wasn't just going to take her home. He wanted to talk with her, maybe get some things off his chest. So they go for a drive, and he's telling her that he wants to talk to her about the marriage because he has some concerns, mostly because she's been traveling a lot.
You just heard a preview of Generation Y. To listen to the rest of this episode, follow This Is Actually Happening wherever you get your podcasts.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus
explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.